And you are fun. Fully aware that it made him sound like kind of a douche, Cooper repeated Nabee's kind words about him.
I'm not convinced, said Hickory Nut.
Hollyworld looked up at him.
But I know you want to find Nabee. Somehow this half-orc knows that too. He's telling you exactly what you want to hear and giving himself a hefty dose of flattery as well.
I never wanted to hear that my sister's wings were ripped off.
The unpleasant details sell the story, the hope that she's still alive. And who better to sell such a story than someone who personally knows otherwise?
Hickory Nut gave Cooper an accusing look, but Cooper was still trying to work out the implications of what he just said. Another female pixie materialized. At least she appeared female. Cooper searched for an Adam's apple.
There's one way to confirm his story.
Hollyworld turned to the new girl.
What's that? We can bring the axe to the pool of true sight.
Hickory Nut rolled his eyes.
I knew it was only a matter of time before someone suggested that. That's a full day's journey, meaning we'll be outside the safety of the glade for an entire night, on evidence provided by this half-orc cretin.
Hey, fuck you, said Cooper.
Tell him the same for me as well.
Nabee says fuck you too.
Hickory Nut pointed at Cooper.
There, you see? Nabee would never say that to me.
Hollyworld stared wide-eyed at Cooper.
Yes, she would.
She turned to Hickory Nut.
I'm sorry to have to break it to you like this. She's never liked you.
She stood up and looked high in the air.
Children of the forest, we leave at dawn.
Chapter 28. Dave woke up on the floor in the cellar of the Whore's Head Inn, which was immediately recognizable by the fact that it contained an enormous wooden dildo, which was the first thing he saw when he opened his eyes. It was right there in his face, pointing at him like he owed it a beej, and it was time to pay up. Pushing himself up off the floor, Dave discovered he was naked. He wondered if his nakedness was in any way related to the proximity of the dildo, and leaned over to give it a sniff. He detected no alarming smell, nor any unusual soreness in his ass, come to think of it. He would assume that his nakedness had nothing to do with the dildo until he remembered or was informed otherwise. The dildo wasn't the only thing on the floor. The whole cellar was a mess, with weapons strewn all over the floor. Nothing remained of the crates that had held them except broken strips of wood. The state of the room, the nakedness, his splitting headache, and his complete lack of memory of the previous night's events all led to one conclusion. He, Frank, Rhonda, Tony the Elf, and Murkwort must have gotten completely shit-faced last night. Dave struggled up the stairs on his squat naked legs, whispering a small prayer to whatever gods might be listening that he hadn't fucked Rhonda. At the top of the stairs, he found the thick wooden door scarred with axe and dagger marks, which he was able to recognize easily due to several hand axes and daggers still sticking into the wood. It was also locked from the outside.
Hello? Dave called out. Frank? Rhonda? Are you there?
Suddenly feeling a little panicky, like there might be something more wrong than the possibility of him having fucked Rhonda, he banged on the door with his fist.
Tony the Elf? Murkwort?
He doesn't know.
Rhonda's voice was faint on the other side of the door, but it was her all right.
Hey! Shouted Dave. I can hear you guys! What's going on? What don't I know?
Are you feeling okay, Dave?
Frank called back to him. That was a step in the right direction. They weren't pretending they couldn't hear him.
I think so. I mean, I'm naked for some reason. My head hurts. I'm locked in the cellar. But otherwise, I guess I'm doing okay.
You don't remember anything about last night?
No, but I'm guessing we got pretty trashed.
After a short pause, Tony the Elf spoke up.
One of us did, in a manner of speaking.
Dave didn't even want to know how far off the deep end he'd gone. With this group, how far out of line did you have to act to warrant getting locked in the cellar? Shit. Had he tried to force himself on Rhonda?
Listen, guys. Whatever happened, I'm really sorry. My alcohol tolerance must be out of whack or something. All I've had to eat for the past 3 days is a turkey leg I picked up off the floor. It's been rough out there.
There was no response from the other side of the door. Were they on the fence about forgiving him? Or at least releasing him? Did they need a bit more of a nudge?
Like I said, I don't remember what happened last night, but I trust you had a good reason to lock me in here, and whatever I did, I'm truly sorry, and I'll do whatever I can to make it right. I know being drunk doesn't excuse my behavior, but maybe, I don't know. Maybe you could give me a little credit for bringing Murkwart in? I mean, he could be the key to getting us all back home.
Dave,
said Frank.
No, you're right. I'm sorry I brought it up. I regretted saying it as soon as the words came out of my mouth. I can't expect to be forgiven for whatever it is I've done just because I potentially saved all of our lives.
Did that sound as insincere and passive-aggressive to them as it sounded to him?
I'm just saying, maybe you could look past whatever indiscretions I may have committed while intoxicated and focus on the positive.
Someone sighed.
Let him out,
said Frank. Dave listened as tables were dragged away from the door, then pushed it open a crack.
Can someone give me my pants?
You can get them yourself, said Tony the Elf. You lost your shit before you lost your shit.
A little bit of the previous night came back to Dave. He remembered shitting himself. Murkwart was walking him to the outhouse, and... Where was Murkwart now? Why was he so quiet?
Come on, guys. Can you at least give me, like, a tarp or something?
He wrenched a hand axe free from the door to hide his junk with and pushed the door open a little wider. Murkwart was sitting on the floor against the wall next to the rear exit. His lifeless eyes were wide open, as was his jaw, showing off his precious metal teeth, as was the gaping hole where his throat used to be. His robes were thick with drying blood.
What the fuck happened to him?
Asked Dave.
You did, said Tony the Elf.
This was so much worse than fucking Rhonda. At least, definitively worse.
How could I? He's a high-level wizard, and I'm just Dave.
Frank shook his head.
Not anymore, you're not. You're a were-rat.
What?
Said Dave.
That's impossible.
He assumed that Frank had some kind of solid evidence to make that specific an accusation, and tried to think of when or how he might have gotten infected by a were-rat, but there was nothing. He shook his head.
Whatever went down last night, you misinterpreted something. I'm not a goddamn were-rat.
There's nothing to misinterpret, said Tony the Elf. We heard a scream out back by the outhouse. When we went to check it out, there was some fucking rat-man monster tearing out Murkwood's throat with its teeth. I grabbed a shovel and clobbered it over the head, knocking it unconscious. It was too late for Murkwart. You were unaccounted for, so instead of killing it, we locked it down in the cellar just in case.
Rhonda wiped a tear from her eye.
We were really hoping you'd run away or something.
Dave sat down at a table. Lycanthropy explained the memory loss and the nakedness. He vaguely remembered a full moon, and a shovel to the head explained his headache well enough. But
how could this have happened? Lycanthropy isn't an airborne virus. I haven't been bitten or scratched by anyone. I haven't had sex with anyone. I haven't... Shit.
What is it? Asked Frank.
The turkey leg.
The one you picked up off the floor?
Asked Rhonda. Dave nodded.
Someone else had taken a few bites.
Rhonda and Tony the Elf exchanged a grimace.
You ate a partially eaten turkey leg you picked up off the floor?
Said Rhonda.
I was starving!
Dave thought back to that dwarf who'd been writing the scrolls and how quickly he'd disappeared. If he'd changed to his dire rat form, he could have easily hidden in the tall grass. Dave pounded the table with his fist.
Fuck! I'm a goddamn were-rat!
Chapter 29 Julian woke up with a massive white pillow in a large, luxurious room, at least by the standards of this world. The walls and furniture all gleamed white, and the air smelled like rose petals. He was wearing a white satin robe with nothing underneath it. The huge window gave him no indication as to where he was, as the view was completely obscured by a heavy white mist.
Shit, Julian whispered to himself. Am I in heaven?
If so, shit was probably an inappropriate first reaction.
Stacy?
He called out. His head felt foggy. He may have still been a little drunk.
Stacy!
Look who's finally awake!
Stacy strode into the room in a white satin robe like the one Julian was wearing. She was followed by a man Julian couldn't recall ever having seen before. He was wearing an identical robe. His brown hair was pinned back in a ponytail, and he had a nicely trimmed goatee. Julian supposed he could have been Jesus and wondered if his own Jewish upbringing was going to cause any complications.
Hello,
Julian said politely, but with just a pinch of, who the hell are you, and why are we all within a napkin's difference of being naked in this room together?
Julian, said Stacy,
This is Darton. Darton Julian.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
Darton stepped forward to offer Julian a handshake, but tripped on the edge of a rug and slammed his shin into the coffee table. He said in lieu of swearing. Perhaps he was still drunk as well. His hand was still extended, so Julian accepted the handshake, but kept his foggy gaze centered on Stacy.
Where are we?
I met Darton at the last bar we went to earlier this morning. He invited us to stay in his suite.
Sounds like you made the responsible choice.
That came out a little harsher than he'd meant for it to, but the harshness might be justified, depending on her answer to his next question.
Where are our clothes?
I had to carry you here, said Stacy, a hint of annoyance in her voice. You threw up on me. Darton here was kind enough to send our clothes out to be cleaned.
It was easy to see how he was currently the dick in the situation, but Julian didn't think it was entirely fair.
I didn't ask to start doing shots at 6 in the morning. You were the one who...
A more important thought occurred to him.
Do you have the...
Not knowing who this Darton guy was, Julian didn't know if he should be mentioning the dice in front of him. Stacy smiled and pulled back the left side of her robe enough to expose the silver chain.
Don't worry. I told him about the dice. He knows a guy who has another one mounted on the head of a walking cane. That's our mark for this evening.
Do we have a plan? Asked Julian. Or am I supposed to just grab his dick and see what happens?
Darton, still rubbing his shin, looked at Julian quizzically.
Perhaps I wasn't clear, but I was actually referring to a literal walking cane.
Julian put his inexplicably hostile feelings toward Darton aside and looked at Stacy.
What do we know about this guy?
Stacy frowned.
Darton? No, the guy with the cane.
But now that she mentioned it, it might be appropriate to discuss what they knew about Darton as well next time they got a moment alone, since they were sharing all their secrets with him.
Alaric of Whitewood, said Darton. Nothing terribly valuable on the surface. He got to start making scrolls and potions, then moved up to rods and wands. Now he mostly trades in real estate. He makes quite a bit of money, and he likes to show it off. I met him a few days ago over breakfast. He was eating a poached Pegasus egg.
Stacy gasped.
That's terrible.
Yes, by all accounts I've heard, they taste atrocious.
Then why would he eat one?
Darton shrugged.
Simply to be seen doing so. They may taste like fermenting garbage, but a Pegasus egg demands 2,000 gold pieces on the open market, and that's typically for people who intend to hatch it. Eating one is merely a means of saying, look how much I can afford to throw away on breakfast, without actually saying it.
What a douche, said Julian. And I can't think of anything we could possibly offer him any douchier than a pimp cane.
A sharp knock on the door made Julian jump.
You needn't be alarmed, said Darton. That will be our clothes.
He turned around, seemingly unaware of the space he occupied, as his right hand swung straight into an expensive-looking vase sitting atop a pedestal on the rear of the plush white sofa. Stacy had to dive, but she managed to catch it, keeping it from smashing to pieces on the floor. She stood up and sighed as Darton walked obliviously to the door.
That must be what a low dexterity score looks like,
Julian muttered to Stacy, while Darton talked to whoever was at the door. Stacy placed the vase back on top of the pedestal.
I hope he survives a trip back across the room.
Having concluded his business with the person out in the hallway, Darton returned to Stacy and Julian with a pile of clean and neatly folded laundry.
Damn, said Stacy, holding up her shiny black leather rogue outfit. I can't believe I can fit in this.
Now that she mentioned it, it looked like a leather onesie for an adolescent stick figure. Julian's robes were whiter than they'd ever been. All the bloodstains were gone. The multitude of tears, slits, and puncture holes caused by blades, claws, and teeth during his time in this world had all been mended, the stitching almost invisible except upon very close inspection. His serape, which had grown dull with dust and dirt, was now more vibrant and colorful than it had been when he bought it off that guy driving the shit cart.
An interesting choice of clothing for a wizard,
said Darton when he reemerged from his bedroom. He'd changed into his own more conventional wizard attire, consisting of royal blue robes decorated with embroidered golden bamboo leaves. He was carrying 2 folded bundles of similar fabric, one of which was forest green and the other maroon.
Wherever did you acquire such an outfit?
This is considered very fashionable where we come from,
Julian didn't know why he felt the compulsion to lie to this guy, especially with Stacy right there to call him out on it. But she just shot him a quick, curious glance and left him at that.
"The height of fashion it may be wherever you're from," said Darton, "but here it draws attention, which we don't want on a reconnaissance mission."
"Reconnaissance mission?" Julian looked at Stacy. "Where are we going?"
Stacy shrugged.
"I had the hotel boy alert me as to Alaric's whereabouts. He's currently having lunch in the restaurant on the top floor of this hotel. Once we all have a clearer idea of who he is and what he's like, we can speak more intelligibly about how we might go about relieving him of his stick."
Darton handed the green bundle of fabric to Stacy and the maroon one to Julian.
"I apologize if these don't meet your high standards of fashion, but they should help you to blend in a little easier."
Julian wanted to tell him he was going to blend his foot up his ass, but he decided against it after considering that Darton was doing them a favor and that it was a stupid thing to say. When they were all dressed in Darton's clothes, they went upstairs as separate parties. Julian and Stacy would be a couple, while Darton would be dining alone. He claimed he didn't want to be directly involved in whatever scheme they hatched up, and he was only there in an advisory capacity. That sounded kind of cowardly to Julian, but Stacy didn't seem surprised by it at all. It must have been part of the deal they'd struck up while he was passed out in the bar. It was probably for the best that they were dining as separate parties anyway. While they were waiting to be seated, Darton bent over to wipe a smudge off his boot, then slammed his head into the serving tray of a passing waitress when he stood back up. They were both covered from head to toe in exotic fruit juices and surrounded by a corona of shattered glass. For as suave and dapper a man as he seemed to like to present himself, Julian couldn't see Darton as anything but a moronic buffoon. The hostess clearly thought so as well. Julian caught her shaking her head before she caught him catching her and snapped back into employee mode, flashing him a wide smile.
"Will it just be the two of you?"
"Yes," Stacy said before Julian had a chance to respond.
"Please follow me."
The hostess grabbed two menus and led them across the dining area. The food smelled amazing, like Thanksgiving dinner in a flower garden. Julian thought about how remarkably similar restaurants here were to restaurants back home. He wondered if that was because Mordred hadn't been thorough with his historical research when he created this world, or because the restaurant business actually hadn't evolved much in the past millennium. The hostess led them to a small table with a white satin tablecloth that hung down to the floor. Like the other tables they'd passed, this one came with two intricately folded napkins, a stoppered glass bottle of some kind of brown sauce, and three shakers. Julian assumed, for now, that the dark gray and white contents of two of them were pepper and salt respectively, and he was curious as to what the granular red contents of the third was. When they were seated and the hostess left them, they opened their menus. There wasn't much of a selection. One side of the menu said pork and the other side said pheasant, with accompanying pictures of a pig and a pheasant under the respective text. Julian didn't think this looked like the sort of restaurant that had much of a barbarian clientele, so he assumed the pictures were there to fill what would otherwise be a lot of empty space. Pork was a safe choice, but Julian had never tried pheasant. He was actually hoping for something a little more exotic, like griffin or owlbear meat, or even one of those giant ants. Sure, he'd already tried it, but not as prepared in the kitchen by a professional cook. As good as it had been, just roasted over a fire, imagine what it might.
"I didn't sleep with him," said Stacy, without lowering her menu. "Shit."
"Who?"
said Julian, feeling pressured to respond before taking the time to consider whether or not playing dumb was really the right move here.
"Darton."
"I don't know how I'm supposed to respond to that."
Julian suddenly grew more indecisive about the pork or pheasant options as he shielded his face with the menu.
"I'm sorry to hear that. Congratulations. You'll get him next time, champ. Why are you even telling me this?"
"You've been scowling at him since we walked out of his bedroom together."
"I wasn't scowling," Julian lied. "It's this island. All the hopping around between different time zones. My internal clock is off."
After a moment of silence, Julian peeked over the top of his menu, then jumped when he discovered Stacy staring at him stoically.
What the hell did she want from him? What had he done to get this third-degree business? She was the one who didn't do the act in question, which didn't even actually qualify as an act in question until she brought it up. Maybe he could come at it from a different direction.
"I'll be happy to listen if there's something you'd like to get off your chest."
No, that was terrible. He was making himself sound like he was ready to hear a confession and maybe hoping to get a glimpse of her tits. Say something else. Say something else.
When you say you didn't sleep, do you mean...
He really needed her to say something just to shut him up.
I mean, we didn't fuck.
Oh.
Julian really wanted another look at that menu.
We just made out a little. Things got a little feely. I'll just give you two a few more minutes,
said a visibly uncomfortable waitress who neither Julian nor Stacy had seen approaching. She scurried away from their table before Julian could plead with her to stay.
Listen, Stacy, said Julian, this is really none of my business.
I'm making it your business, said Stacy. We were drunk, we got to talking, one thing led to another. I might have actually gone all the way with him if fate hadn't intervened.
As long as she was forcing him to talk about it, Julian couldn't be faulted for asking about this particularly curious detail.
How exactly did fate intervene?
His, weapon went off prematurely.
That made Julian happier than it should have. He tried not to show it.
Oh,
he said again.
I want you to know, I'm not telling you this because I feel I owe you an explanation.
Well, of course you don't,
said Julian, somehow feeling like he was the asshole here.
You're a grown woman. You're free to do what you want with whom you want.
I also wasn't asking for your permission.
And I'm not trying to give it.
Julian calmed himself when he saw their approaching waitress turn around and walk away again.
Maybe it would help if you told me why you're telling me this.
We spent the night together in a grove of trees on a flying island below a full moon in a sky full of stars. If you didn't want me then, is it safe to assume you don't want me at all?
No, that's not a safe assumption at all.
Julian had sensed that tension between them was coming to a crescendo last night. He supposed this conversation had to happen sooner or later.
Back home, I would have been all over you given the slightest hint of an invitation.
What's wrong with me now? Asked Stacy. I'm objectively and quantifiably more attractive now than I was then.
It's not you. It's me.
Upon seeing what looked like the desire to stab him in Stacy's narrowed eyes, Julian realized the genericness of what he'd said.
Wait, I didn't mean it like that. I mean in a real physiological and emotional way. My wiring's all screwed up or something. You know that I've only masturbated once since I've been in this world? And even then it was because I hadn't felt the urge to do so for so long that I started to get concerned. It took me over half an hour to get an erection. I'm not...
Stacy cleared her throat. Julian sighed.
Oh, the waitress is behind me, isn't she?
I'm going to leave these here for you.
The waitress placed two tall glasses of orange liquid on the table, then started to retreat. Julian was ready for her this time.
Excuse me, I believe we're ready to order.
Very good, sir. She flashed him a nervous smile. And what would you like?
The pheasant.
I'll have the same, said Stacy.
And could you please point me to the nearest restroom? Asked Julian.
The waitress pointed to the back of the restaurant.
It's right over there.
Julian stood up and excused himself. Stacy sipped her drink and looked pleasantly surprised.
Try to keep it under half an hour.
That was unnecessarily hurtful. Julian sulked on the way to the bathroom. He supposed Stacy was right to feel the way she did. He wasn't acting normal. He was fucking this up, and he was going to lose her if he didn't get his shit together. The bathroom was an interesting design. There was a trough to pee in, like one might find at a stadium, the bottom of which sloped downward from the left side to the right. Julian guessed about 8 men could piss side by side before the trough leveled off, the top of it covered by 3 2-inch-thick pieces of wood, each perfectly square, polished, and with a circular hole in the middle. Looking through one of the holes, Julian could see all the way down to the desert floor. A couple of things occurred to him. This bathroom had no stalls, and this was the only bathroom in the place. Those wooden boards must be for anyone who needed to sit in order to do their business, man or woman, number 1 or number 2. He made a mental note to tell Stacy she might want to hold off until they got back up to the room if she needed to go.
What are you doing?
Said Darton, storming into the bathroom and slipping on someone else's pee. He barely managed to grab onto a notch in the rough stone wall and keep himself from taking a nasty spill on the floor. Staring at a toilet seat was the obvious answer, but Julian thought he could do better.
I was trying to pee, if that's okay with you.
I meant this whole time. I've been trying to get your attention from the other side of the restaurant. Have you forgotten why we're here?
Julian thought for a moment while he peed. Finally, it came back to him.
Well, of course I do. We just had some stuff we had to talk about.
Oh? Darton's voice had a hint of concern in it. He was obviously wondering if Stacy had told Julian that he'd jizzed his pants.
What sort of stuff?
Stuff.
Julian found it odd that Darton wasn't peeing.
Did you just come in here to watch me pee?
No, said Darton.
I came in here to get you focused.
Alaric of Whitewood is dining alone by the window on the northwest side of the restaurant.
From where you're sitting, he's directly to the right of the fat palm tree in the center of the floor. If he's in your line of sight, he'll be easy to spot. The cane is actually on his table, head facing outward.
Julian shook his head.
That's just desperate for attention.
He rinsed his hands in a continuously flowing waterfall on the wall opposite the piss trough, assuming that was the purpose for it being there. There wasn't any soap that he could see, so a thorough rinse would have to do.
Sad, isn't it? Said Darton.
Julian's mind was preoccupied with the lack of hand soap, and he had to mentally backtrack to understand what Darton was referring to.
Yes, thanks for the intel. I've got an idea.
What is it?
Nothing big. I'll run it by Stacy.
Julian walked out before Darton could respond, smugly satisfied, knowing that Darton would certainly want to say in what Julian was planning, but wouldn't follow him out of the bathroom and be seen talking to him. He scanned the dining area as he walked back to his table, casually looking for someone sitting alone with a walking cane on their table. But the fat palm tree in the center of the room, which Julian hadn't even noticed until now, obscured quite a lot. When he turned his attention to his own table, he found Stacy sniffling and wiping away a tear.
"What's wrong?"
he asked, quickly sitting down.
"I'm sorry, Julian. You must think I'm such a bitch."
"No, of course I don't."
Julian shook open a folded napkin and wiped away a tear she'd missed.
"I mean, well, kinda, but I like that about you."
Stacy snort laughed.
"What happened while I was in the bathroom?"
"The waitress overheard us."
Julian nodded.
"Yeah, a couple of times, I think."
"She's in a relationship with an elf." Stacy's eyes glistened with tears. "You were right. It's physiological. You guys just don't get aroused that often or that easily. Something to do with your long lifespans. If you reproduced at human rates, the world would be overrun with starving elves."
"That makes sense from an evolutionary standpoint. But is it really something to get so worked up about?"
Stacy snorted again.
"No, stupid. I'm not crying because we're not going to be humping around the clock. I'm crying because I feel bad for being so mean to you."
"Don't even give it another thought," said Julian. "I was worried about this, too. You can't know how relieved I am right now. I mean, given the way I feel about you, I thought there was something wrong with me. Let's focus on getting the rest of those dice, getting Mordred, and getting back home in our proper bodies, and maybe we'll give that humping around the clock thing a go."
Stacy smiled and gave Julian's hand a squeeze. Tension left the table like an uninvited third.
"Ow!"
said Julian. Something had struck him in the temple. Some long-dead king stared up at him from the side of a silver coin which had just landed on the table. Julian looked in the direction it had been thrown from. Darton was glaring at him with a frustrated look on his face. Julian nodded and pocketed the coin. Now that his issues with Stacy were resolved, at least for the time being, he could once again focus on the somehow less stressful task of trying to steal an artifact from a powerful wizard. Alaric of Whitewood was easy to spot once Julian made an effort to find him. This was in no small part due to the fact that he was so obviously desperate to be spotted. He sat at his table alone, sipping some steamy beverage from a powder-blue porcelain cup, hopefully watching each person who walked by his table. His lips tightened in frustration every time someone passed without sparing a look down at his walking cane, which accounted for most of the people who passed.
"Give me the pendant," he said to Stacy.
Stacy put her hand over her heart where the pendant hung beneath her robe.
"Why?"
"I want to wear it and casually walk by his table and see if it provokes a reaction."
"That doesn't sound like much of a plan."
"It's not a plan. It's an attempt to shake things loose, see what happens. Maybe we'll learn something that will contribute to a plan."
Stacy pulled the silver dragon claw pendant over her head and slid it across the table, but didn't remove her hand.
"I don't think I have to tell you how important this is, right?"
"I think I'm at least as aware of its importance as you are."
"I don't like the idea of flashing these around in front of so many sets of eyes, any of which could belong to Mordred."
"That guy's already flashing his around. If Mordred's in this restaurant right now, he's probably already seen it.
We've got to gamble on that not being the case in order to better our odds of being able to get one more of those dice out of the public eye for good.
Stacy smiled appreciatively. That was some fancy diplomacy footwork. She lifted one side of her hand like a clamshell, keeping the pendant shielded from view, but available for Julian to take. Julian took the pendant and slipped the chain over his head. He tucked the dragon claw encased die under Darton's robe, then walked quickly back to the bathroom. He had no excuse to walk from his and Stacy's table to Alaric of Whitewood's table, but using the bathroom as a starting point, he could casually go anywhere in the restaurant without raising any eyebrows. Or so he assumed. When he left the bathroom, wearing the pendant above the robe, Julian pretended not to notice a few more turned heads and paused conversations than he was comfortable with. Making his way counterclockwise along the windowed perimeter of the restaurant, he kept Alaric of Whitewood in his peripheral vision while pretending to take more of an interest in the view offered by the windows.
"Hey!"
Alaric called out as Julian passed. Julian had set the hook. Now it was just a matter of reeling it in and figuring out how to get it in the boat. Julian feigned being startled, then stopped and looked down at the portly man at the table.
"I'm sorry, are you talking to me?"
"I am indeed. I couldn't help but notice that curious trinket you wear around your neck."
"Oh, this old thing?"
Julian looked down at his pendant.
"I picked this up some time ago in a magical oddity shop. I never did manage to get any functional magic out of it, but I like the dragon claw design."
His gaze dropped down to the cane on Alaric's table.
"Oh my! I see your cane has an identically carved stone."
"Carved? Perhaps. Now that I see an identical one, I wonder if they weren't artificially manufactured. Some apprentice wizard is probably using his master's laboratory to replicate these for a copperpiece each, enchanting them with a double-folded illusion spell to give them the appearance of powerful magic, then selling them at 10,000 times the production cost."
Julian smiled to himself. They were trying to run the same con on each other. Alaric had a better thought-out story, but lacked the delivery skills to sell it. It was too perfect, too memorized, not natural-sounding at all. Julian shrugged.
"Live and learn." "May I hold yours? I'd like to inspect it to see if it matches mine upon a closer examination."
A difficult situation. Julian didn't want to let the die out of his possession, but neither did he want to seem overprotective of it. He searched his mind for a compromise.
"I'll show you mine if you show me yours."
"Why the fuck did I just say that?"
"Of course," said Alaric. "Be my guest."
He gestured at his walking cane. Julian wondered what the consequences would be for just picking up the cane and running like a motherfucker. Almost certainly bad, he imagined. Alaric would have to assume the same would be true for him, and he had the added disadvantage of being seated and having Julian between him and the exit. Reluctantly, Julian slipped the chain over his head and held it out for Alaric, who was trying his best to appear disinterested as he accepted it. Julian picked up the cane and pretended to examine it, but kept his attention focused on the pendant. Alaric shut one eye and held the pendant up close to his open one.
"Just as I thought. Cheap reproductions. Still, my niece might enjoy it to play with. I can't believe I'm about to say this, but I'll give you 10 gold pieces for it."
"Nice one, Alaric." Julian quickly thought up a counteroffer.
"I think I'll hang on to it for the time being. Like I said, I like how it looks on me. As a matter of fact, a matching walking cane might be something I'd part with 5 gold pieces for."
"The cane itself is nice and sturdy. I'll keep it until I find another that suits me. But thank the gods you refused my offer. I might need to have my head examined. Truth be told, I don't even like my niece that much. 3 gold pieces is my final offer."
It was fascinating, like the exact opposite of a bidding war.
"That's very generous of you," said Julian. "But I couldn't possibly—"
"Alaric of Whitewood," said Darton,
his arms spread wide as he approached, coming within a centimeter of smacking a passing waitress in the face.
"I spotted you from across the room and said to myself, what's my old friend doing here dining all alone?"
He sat down at the table, a move which Julian hadn't been so bold as to make uninvited. He leaned in close to peer at the pendant.
"Whatever do you have there?"
His eyes widened in fake surprise.
"Why, it matches your cane!" "Yes," said Alaric. I saw this elf walking by wearing it, and I thought it the most curious thing.
Indeed it is, Darton put out his hand. May I?
Of course.
Alaric held the pendant over Darton's open palm without so much as glancing Julian's way for a hint of permission. It was a calculated move, meant to provoke a reaction from Julian giving away how dear the die was to him. Amateur hour stuff. Even if it was a worthless bauble, as they were both pretending, one doesn't just hand over someone else's shit to a total stranger without permission. Julian could see straight through his motives and wouldn't give him the satisfaction of a reaction.
Yeah!
Julian yelped as Alaric dropped the pendant, which seemed to fall right through Darton's hand. Fortunately, Darton caught it by the chain before it hit the floor.
Are you quite all right? Asked Alaric.
Yes, that was a hiccup. I hiccup weird.
Clumsy-ass Darton had just blown Julian's facade of coolness. Then again, Julian shouldn't have been so panicked in the first place. It wasn't made of glass, after all. The die was nothing if not durable, meant to be thrown around. Hell, it had survived hitting the sidewalk after falling out the top-floor window of the Beauregard Hotel without so much as a scratch. Darton held up the pendant and examined it, then held it out to Julian.
You want to be careful with a prize like this. You don't want it falling into the wrong hands.
He was about as subtle as an eight-dicked gorilla jerking off at a funeral. Julian placed Alaric's cane on the table and took the pendant from Darton as calmly as he could.
Thank you,
he said, trying not to sound too curt.
I think I need to go to the bathroom now.
Why did he say it like that? It sounded like it was in response to what Darton said, which made it even weirder than suddenly announcing that he had to go to the bathroom without emphasizing anything. But that ship had sailed. He couldn't very well stick around and try to defuse it. Not going to the bathroom now would only raise the awkwardness even further. Hoping that Darton at least took the hint, Julian excused himself, tucked the pendant under his robe, and clenched his ass cheeks as he scurried to the bathroom. If he could pull off looking like he was having an IBS attack and immediately needed to take a shit, that might help to explain the whole bathroom thing. Naturally, when he arrived in the bathroom, a bald half-elf with a white grizzled beard was sitting on one of the square boards taking a dump. If there was anything more awkward than suddenly and ardently announcing his plans to visit the bathroom to a couple of strangers at a restaurant, it was finding said bathroom occupied when he actually had no business to conduct in there. A series of response options formed in Julian's head like he was a Terminator.
Wait, this isn't the exit.
Oh, I guess it was just a fart. Did you see a small child come in here?
Fuck you, asshole.
None of those options sounded great, and Julian thought he might be able to squeeze out a little more pee if he really concentrated. The half-elf's gaze followed Julian to the other side of the trough as he hiked up his robes and aimed his dick.
Nice weather today.
Oh my god, are you fucking serious? Is it acceptable in this world to talk to someone while they're holding their dick? Did this guy not have a newspaper or a spellbook he could be reading? Did he not realize that they were flying over a desert on which the gods themselves had prohibited atmospheric precipitation?
Sure is.
The half-elf let out a series of farts, then a small groan.
I don't recommend the pheasant.
Shit.
Thanks. I'll keep that in mind.
You having trouble?
The half-elf nodded toward Julian's dick.
Huh? No, I just...
A middle-aged human woman with striking red hair stumbled into the bathroom.
Make way! This dam's about to burst!
She hiked up her mint-green robes, sat down hard on the board all the way to the right, then released an explosion of wet-sounding farts.
God's mercy!
She said between pants.
That pheasant!
The half-elf, only temporarily distracted by the woman shitting two boards down from him, looked back at Julian.
Told you!
The woman glared at Julian, making him realize that he was still gawking at her.
This isn't a show!
I'm sorry.
Julian focused back on his dick, which was still not willing to give up a drop of justification for his being there.
What's his problem?
The woman asked the half-elf.
He's having urination troubles. Something wrong with the pipes. Probably been spending too much time in the alley behind live noob gnomes.
There's nothing wrong with my pipes, said Julian. I just need a little privacy.
The red-haired woman made a show of averting her eyes.
A thousand pardons, Your Majesty. Wield not your scepter before us common folk.
Oh, come on. It's not like...
We'll be out of your way when we've concluded our business here,
said the old half-elf sharply.
When I was younger, the elves would spit upon our kind. I like to think the times have changed, but I've always been naively optimistic.
The woman patted the half-elf's knee.
Don't let this one sour you on elves completely. There are good ones out there. I've plenty of elven friends in the city who'd never look down on their half-breed brethren.
I'm not looking down on you,
said Julian, pushing his bladder muscles for all they were worth, which still didn't amount to a goddamn drop.
Ha!
Barked the half-elf.
So he says, while literally looking down on me.
I'm standing up. You're sitting down. How else am I supposed to look at you?
The old half-elf pointed a swollen-knuckled finger at Julian.
We may be down right now, but mark my words. One day, we'll rise up, see if we don't.
Great, said Julian. I hope you do.
The red-haired woman gasped.
Even in the forest? I've never met an elf this rude.
What? What did I say?
Don't think I didn't catch your little wordplay there.
I didn't.
I hope you do.
The woman looked at the half-elf.
As in, I hope you do rise up and get out of the loo, so I can be alone to play with my royal scepter.
Of all the...
The half-elf glared up at Julian again.
That settles it. I'm staying until you've finished.
Me too, said the woman. We'll see how long he can hold out.
That's fine, said Julian. You can stay here all day. I don't even have to.
Would you mind telling me what...
Darton stomped into the bathroom with a whirlwind of attitude, then abruptly stopped when he saw the two other occupants of the bathroom shitting side by side.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
He stepped up to the trough next to Julian and began hitching up his robe.
What's the meaning of showing off your...
He glanced at the others, then spoke more quietly.
Thing like that.
I'm trying to pee!
Darton rolled his eyes.
Not that thing. The other thing, in the restaurant.
Oh, right. I was trying to get a reaction from Al...
Julian supposed he should be following Darton's lead of giving away as few details as possible to listening ears.
I mean, from your associate. I was doing reconnaissance, just like we talked about.
You were calling attention to yourself and to your... thing.
He's been doing that since he came in here,
said the old half-elf. The red-haired woman harumphed.
It didn't look all that attention-worthy to me, even for an elf.
Julian ignored them.
I was doing fine.
How was that fine? Asked Darton.
He had your thing in his hand. I'm not sure you understand how precious a thing that is.
This is getting weird now, said the half-elf. I think I'll leave him to it.
I had his thing in my hand as well. We were quietly holding each other's things, not calling any attention to ourselves, until you barged in and started gawking at my thing and asking to hold it. That's when people started looking at us.
I believe I'll join you,
said the red-haired woman. She and the half-elf reached between their legs and said an incantation, which Julian assumed must have been a wipe spell because they let their robes drop down and didn't even wash their hands in the waterfall before exiting the bathroom.
Did they say they were carrying on like that here in the restaurant?
The half-elf asked. Once they were out of the bathroom, apparently forgetting that elves have an extremely keen sense of hearing.
That's a problem with young people today,
said the red-haired woman.
You live such a debaucherous lifestyle long enough, and you need to start stroking each other off in public just to get aroused anymore.
Have you ever?
Absolutely not. Have you?
There's an empty table over there. We could...
Let's go!
Julian, said Darton.
Julian focused back on the conversation inside the bathroom.
What?
I'm sorry for not trusting your instincts. You did well. We'll discuss what you've learned when we reconvene in my...
That's him,
said one of two large men wearing plain gray robes as they burst into the bathroom. They were dressed like wizards, but they had builds more suited to barbarian or fighter classes. Julian didn't know whether it was him or Darton they were talking about, but he suddenly felt like he might actually have to pee.
Is your name Darton of Wineridge?
Asked the other impressively large wizard. Julian let out a silent sigh of relief. Sucks for Darton, but Julian had little doubt he was reaping what he'd sown. Darton hesitated for a second, like he was considering lying about his identity, but then reconsidered.
Yes.
We need you to come with us.
And who exactly are you?
I'm Constable Marlowe, and this is Constable Frum. We're on the Crescent Shadow Council of Justice.
May I ask what this is about?
You're wanted for questioning in the murder of a Professor Slugbo von Hottenvolt.
Slugbo? Darton gasped.
Slugbo's dead?
And you think I had something to do with it?
That's preposterous. I barely knew the man.
Constable Frum sneered.
That's why you're on a first-name basis.
Am I under arrest?
You can be if you like,
said Constable Marlowe.
It's been a while since I've had to use my tranquility stick.
He pulled out a black steel club crackling with electric purple energy from a sheath on his belt. It looked anything but tranquil.
That won't be necessary.
Darton turned to Julian, who had hoped to remain known as just a guy taking a piss in the wrong place at the wrong time, and not an associate of a murder suspect.
Julian, you and Stacy can wait in my room. This is a misunderstanding which shouldn't take too long to clear up.
Not only did Darton acknowledge that he knew them, but he'd said their names as well.
Awesome.
The two constables eyed Julian suspiciously, and the pee finally started flowing.
Come on, then, said Darton. Let's get this over with.
Constable Marlowe led the way out of the bathroom, followed by Darton. Constable Frum took the rear, his hand on the handle of his tranquility stick. Julian imagined he was looking for a reason to use it. Julian rinsed his hands in the waterfall, then wiped them dry on his robe. No, Darton's robe. He felt a sudden urgency to change back into his own clothes. He walked briskly out of the bathroom and back to his table, thankful to find Stacy still there.
"Where the hell have you been?" asked Stacy.
"Bathroom."
"Wow." She licked pheasant grease off her fingers. "It's been a while. I guess I'd better let it air out a bit before I go in."
"Did you see Darton?"
Stacy glanced at Darton's unoccupied table.
"No, I was starving. You've seriously got to try this pheasant."
"I'm good for now, thanks."
"How'd it go with that Alaric guy?"
Julian shrugged.
"Not great, not terrible. We both tried to con the other into selling our dye."
"Do you think that's information we can work with?"
"I think we need to cut our losses and get the hell out of here."
He leaned in closer to Stacy and whispered.
"Darton was just hauled off as a murder suspect."
Stacy's eyes went wide as she bit into a side of her bird.
"Are you fucking with me?"
she asked with a mouthful of pheasant meat.
"No," said Julian. "And he blabbed our names to the cops, as well as the fact that we're staying in his room."
"Who got murdered?"
"Nobody we know, thank God. Slugo von Hufflepuff or something like that."
"That can't be right. That sounds like a bullshit name."
"It is a bullshit name. I said it was something like that. I was afraid I was going to be arrested. It's not like I was taking notes. I knew that guy was bad news."
Stacy's expression turned more serious as she swallowed her pheasant meat.
"Wait a minute. You've still got the dye, don't you?"
"Yeah."
Julian pulled his robe back to show the chain.
"Give it here. No offense, but I feel more secure having it where I can feel and make sure it's there."
"With pleasure."
It was more responsibility than Julian wanted. He slipped the chain over his head and handed over the pendant. Stacy wore the chain around her neck, tucking the pendant under her borrowed robe.
"Any idea on how we might get off this island?"
"First, we need to stop in Darton's room."
"Why?"
"Because I want to get my own clothes back on, and I have it on good authority that you're going to need to use a bathroom really soon."
Chapter 30 Catherine watched the pre-dawn light spawning on the eastern horizon. She had a nice view from the captain's quarters, where she and Captain Longfellow had passed out over shots of rum the night before. She was stiff and crampy from sleeping with her face on her arms on a hard wooden table while sitting on a hard wooden chair, but at least she'd slept, which she doubted she'd been able to do in a cramped cabin full of rapists. She still hadn't quite gotten her tolerance back up to her pre-vampire levels, so the rum had put her down relatively early. Judging by the lack of wolf bites on him, Captain Longfellow had been a gentleman as he continued drinking alone, with his feet up on the table next to his nearly empty rum bottle and one arm hanging over the back of his chair. He appeared positively comfortable as he snored away the early morning hours. By the light of a half-melted candle, Catherine prepared her spells for the day. As she focused on the flame, her options became clear in her mind. For her zero-level spells, she chose to purify food and water because some of the sea creatures people were reeling in the previous day had looked kind of nasty, and it could never hurt to have the means to make seawater potable.
and she chose 3 mending spells because she'd seen a few nets, fishing rods, and miscellaneous other things on the boat that could use a touch of repair. First-level spells were also easy to choose. A magic fang to assist Butterbean in the event that she needed some extra protection from any ne'er-do-wells aboard the boat, and to speak with animals so that she could get in a little talk with him if time allowed. She spent a little more time reviewing her level 2 spell options as they were still new to her. A lot of them had cooler effects than what any of the level 1 spells could offer, but there were also a couple of duds, such as one spell, which would allow her to take the form of a tree for a few hours. There were precious few circumstances where that would be useful, and even then, it would be boring as shit. One spell she considered choosing would temporarily increase her strength score by 4 points. She wondered if that would make her as strong as she'd been when she was a vampire. She might wait until she got back on land to try that one out. She'd want to punch something, and all the punchable things around here belonged to Captain Longfellow. Sorting through the options in her mind a bit more, she discovered one more spell which would mimic another one of her lost vampire powers. Spider climb, as it was called, would allow her to climb up walls and even crawl along ceilings with ease. She remembered scaling the parking garage of the Beauregard Casino Resort and how awesome that had felt. Here on a boat, she might be able to make use of such a spell to climb the mast or rigging if one of the crewmen needed a hand with something. But if she was being honest with herself, she didn't really give a shit about helping the crewmen. Climbing the masts and riggings just sounded like a lot of fun. How many more times would she get to ride on an old-timey boat like this? When she finished preparing her spells, it was light enough to see the main deck more clearly through the dusty windows. She was far from the only one to be getting an early start on the day. Passengers lined the sides and rear of the boat as it rocked gently on the calm sea. They all had lines in the water. Catherine supposed that she also bore some of the responsibility for pulling in some fish, but it was pretty crowded down there. She'd drop a line when it thinned out a little. It was still too dark to distinguish anyone at that distance, but Catherine tried to see if she could make out the shapes of Randy, Alexei, Denise, or the man she was trying to trick into raping her. She spotted a couple of maybes, but no one she was certain of. Finally, the top sliver of golden sun peeked over the glittering liquid horizon. It was magnificent. As far as reasons to be grateful to no longer be a vampire, this came a close second to the ability to get shit-faced. The Hallmark card perfection of the scene lasted only a moment. When the sun was about a quarter of the way exposed, something else appeared on the horizon right next to it. Something tiny, but jarring and off-putting, like a fly in a bowl of white soup. Catherine couldn't hear what anyone was saying through the windows and from as high up as she was, but the speck had caused some commotion at the rear of the boat. Some people grabbed their neighbors by the shoulder and pointed at the black speck on the horizon, while others frantically reeled in their lines. The commotion spread like wildfire up both sides of the boat, finally producing a sound that Catherine could hear. It was like a cross between a church bell and a cowbell. It brought Captain Longfellow out of his deep, snore-filled slumber like a cattle prod up the ass.
"What is it? What's happening?"
His little monkey shrieked, jumping up and down on the table and pointing out at the blemish on the horizon. Clever little thing.
"There's something out there," said Catherine, hoping that everyone was making a huge deal of nothing, but fearing that wasn't the case. "Maybe a tiny uncharted island? Or a humpback whale?"
Captain Longfellow peered through the window.
"That be no whale, Miss Catherine. Lord Shitflinger, fetch me my spyglass."
Lord Shitflinger was an interjection which Catherine had been unfamiliar with until now, but she liked the sound of it and thought she might start using it. As for the captain's other exclamation, how the hell was she supposed to know where the hell his spyglass was, or even what it was? When the monkey, which had inexplicably launched itself from the table onto a shelf cluttered with junk, returned with a polished cherry tube with a glass lens mounted with brass at both ends, much of Catherine's confusion was resolved. But after she parted ways with the people on this boat, she thought she'd probably still use Lord Shitflinger as an interjection. Captain Longfellow extended his shitty primitive telescope and squinted through the eyepiece.
"Aye, just as I thought, Castiglian raiders."
He looked Catherine up and down, which worried her due to its distinct lack of perviness.
"How well can you handle a sword?"
Again, Catherine felt a deep sense of anxiety in the pit of her stomach from the lack of innuendo in his voice.
"I'm better with a scythe."
"Gods have mercy! Some folks should never leave the shore. will not be boarded by stalks of wheat.
It's a legitimate weapon. I can fight fine.
Yay. I've no doubt you do a fine job keeping wild dogs and pigs away from your flock of sheep. But when it comes to fighting, the deck of a ship is no place for a fireman, lass.
I'm not a goddamn farmer, said Catherine. I could kick your Jolly Roger to ass. You wanna go? She put up her fists, feeling only a little ridiculous due to all the adrenaline pumping through her. Captain Longfellow grinned and winked.
Maybe after. Now stay here and don't touch anything.
Before Catherine could tell him to go fuck himself, he was out the door and halfway down the ladder. Catherine folded her arms.
What an asshole.
Lord Shiftflinger screeched angrily.
Good. I hope you do tell him. And you can tell him I hope they cut his dick off, too.
She turned away from the monkey and squinted out the window. The approaching boat was now so close, she could identify it as a boat without the aid of a spyglass. At the front and rear of the maiden's voyage, crewmen were distributing rusty, short-bladed swords from barrels to all the passengers. Considering how crowded it was on the deck now, and how much more so it would be once a boatload of pirates hopped on board, Catherine could see how short blades might be more effective in these circumstances than a scythe, which required a bit of room to properly wield. But that didn't make him any less of a dick for talking down to her like that. Once the men and a not unsubstantial number of women were armed, they were directed to their positions. Many were ordered to stay on the front and rear decks, while others were sent to man the cabin tiers, standing on ladder rungs, holding the ladders with one hand and swords in the other. Seeing the women being given combat responsibilities further infuriated Catherine. This wasn't some backwards-ass sexist thing. Captain Longfellow had singled her out in particular as being too ill-suited to fight. After fuming about it for a moment, she considered that she might have grown on him during last night's drinking session, and he was simply trying to spare her. If she could accidentally woo Captain Righteous, it wasn't out of the question that this lonely old sea dog might have become smitten with her. But that theory only made her feel shittier. How was it going to look when the sword stopped clanging and the blood stopped flowing, and she'd spent the whole time watching the carnage from above in the captain's quarters like some prized piece of treasure or booty? That wouldn't do at all. She was no man's booty. At least, she refused to be defined as such. Then again, maybe Captain Longfellow had a point. She would be a liability, getting in the way of people who knew far better than her how to fight aboard a ship. He was the captain, after all, and on a ship, one obeys the captain's orders. Catherine tried to make herself believe that the secondary line of reasoning had nothing to do with the sleek and intimidating black boat slicing through the water in a trajectory to put it right alongside the maiden's voyage. Black sails jutted out from either side, stretched between long poles like the pectoral fins of a deformed blowfish. The maiden's voyage had similarly styled sails, which were currently being extended and expanded for what little good it was going to do them, but they weren't nearly as aesthetically thought out as the other boat's sails. They were made of plain brown canvas, like one might find stretched over the top of any covered wagon. No dragons, no flames, no threatening slogans or mottos. Pure utilitarian, like the rest of the boat. Having sailed all of the previous day, Catherine knew what speed the maiden's voyage sails were capable of, and it wasn't anywhere close to the speed the black boat was currently moving. She thought it was a little sad that they were even making the effort. The black boat was about half the size of the maiden's voyage, and it looked to only have about a quarter of the amount of people on board, but those people looked like badasses. Their bodies were covered in muscles, scars, and tattoos. Catherine wanted to count the fact that approximately a third of them were missing limbs as a disadvantage for their side, but she knew in her heart that the fighting skills they'd acquired leading up to those losses and the recklessness with which they were still prepared to sail into combat probably counted as more of an advantage, especially considering that most of those who had lost arms had replaced them with sharpened steel prostheses. In front of the main mast, a machine that resembled a massive crossbow swiveled in the maiden's voyage direction. One of the crewmen attached something to the tip of the similarly massive bolt. She couldn't make out what it was due to the distance and the dirty window, but it looked like some kind of bag. What good would that do? Certainly, it could only serve to dull the projectile's impact. Once he had secured the thing on the thing, he went around to the back of the swivel-mounted weapon, peered into a scope of some sort, and made some minute adjustments to the weapon's aim. A second later, the projectile was flying straight at Catherine. She dropped to the floor,
before she had time to fully consider that the wall was just as unlikely to protect her as the window was, her thoughts were interrupted by the crash of shattering glass, splintering wood, and the intense heat and blinding light of the other side of the room suddenly engulfed in flames. Catherine led Butterbean outside. "Stay here!" Butterbean whimpered